Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here. Before we start, can I kindly ask you to look at your phone and make sure that it is on silent? Thank you so much. Welcome to the Maurice Amato Lecture in Sephardic Studies, Absence and Presence. The Maurice Amato Lecture is under the auspices of the Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies. We are grateful to Alan D. Levy. We are grateful to Maurice Amato Foundation. We're grateful to Professor Sarah Stein. And of course, we're grateful to Dahlia Sofer for being here. A couple of things I would just like to remind you of. We have a lot of pamphlets. We have our calendar back there. Please, if you have not signed up to be on our list, please go ahead and do so. I promise you, we do not bombard you with emails. We just let you know what's going on, and we have a wonderful calendar of events. When we're looking at the Balkan Wars and the Jewish community of the Ottoman Empire, the time originally was at noon on April 19th, and it has changed to 2 p.m., so I just wanted you to take note of that. Also, affairs of the mind. Unfortunately, we made a mistake. We put Tuesday, April 19th, and the date is Thursday, April 19th. So just those that memo. What I would like to do is introduce our wonderful writer, Dahlia Sofer. Dahlia Sofer is the author of the novel The Septembers of Shiraz, which was selected as a New York Times, quote, notable book of the year. It was a finalist for the Jewish Book Award, was long listed for the Orange Prize and the Impact Dublin Literary Award, and has been translated and published in 16 countries, including France, Germany, Holland, Hungary, Israel, Italy, Russia, Serbia, really, that's wonderful, Spain, Turkey, and the UK. Dahlia is a recipient of the Whiting Writers Award, the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize, the Siren Land Fellowship, and the Sammy Rohr Choice Award, and has contributed essays and reviews to various publications, including the New York Times Book Review, the LA Review Books, and The Believer. Dahlia was born in Tehran, Iran, and she moved at the age of 11 to New York, where she attended Lycée Français de New York and later New York University. She received an MFA in fiction from Sarah Lawrence College and has twice been a resident at Yaddo in Saratoga Springs, New York, and the Santa Mandelina Foundation in Italy. She lives in New York City, and we are honored that you're able to come out to the sunshine and join us. The way we're going to do it is we're going to have Dahlia read some passages from her book and a new work that she's writing, and then I will ask some questions, and then we'll turn it over to you for some Q&A. Okay, thank you.
Two books, one that was published some years ago called The Septembers of Shiraz, which is a story of a man who's wrongly imprisoned in Iran after the revolution, and it sort of chronicles his unraveling throughout the book. The passage I'll read is from a section where he has been released from prison and has just met with smugglers in anticipation of escaping from the country with his wife, Farnaz, and their young daughter. His brother, Javad, has already escaped, as has his sister, Shahla. Oh, and Isaac, his name is Isaac Amin, and he's a jeweler and a gemologist. Outside, he reaches for Farnaz's hand and they walk together in silence. They pass by a one-legged man in a wheelchair who reminds Isaac of Mehdi. On the windowsills of the neighboring homes are oval trays of grass announcing the arrival of Nowruz, the Persian New Year. "Look, it's the New Year already," Farnaz says. "People are growing their grass and we forgot to grow ours." "It's not too late. If we get the seeds today, we'll still have it in time. Would you like that?" "Yes," she says. "I'd like it very much." We should celebrate it here one last time. So she wishes to go ahead with the trip. She has insinuated it without coming out and saying as much. He does not press her further. He too believes that they should go. And the mirror, he says, we'll put it in the middle of the table this time, not at the edge. No, not the edge, she laughs. He had been the one who had placed the mirror on the ceremonial table that previous year, along with the rest of the ritual items, the goldfish, the painted eggs, the grass. They had just arrived at their beach house, where they liked to spend the holidays, and he remembers the scent of humid cedar rising from the wooden beams of the ceiling and fusing with the smell of cooking, which would begin as a single note of caramelizing onions and would expand as the hours progressed, becoming an orchestra of scents of meats, spices, and herbs. He recalls, too, the curtains moving with the breeze, the distant breath of the waves, and the open windows forming an invisible artery through the neighborhood, the sounds of clanking dishes and laughter traveling from one house to the next. But when the lights went out, another blackout so frequent in the early days of the war, he hurried in the dark to the dining room console for a candle, knocking against the mirror along the way. For an instant, he stood completely still, knowing that one black silent second separated him from that devastating sound of shattering glass. The sound brought with it his fretful wife, who knelt to the floor in her white dress and picked up the broken pieces, mumbling, "Oh, but it's bad luck. A broken mirror on the new mirror is such bad luck." And he had knelt beside her, telling her that it's just glass, nothing more, that it's all just a silly superstition. But she shook her head, saying, "It's not a superstition, it's a fact." Her doggedness irritated him, but not because he found her convictions ridiculous. On the contrary, he too believed in the silly superstition and wished that someone could convince him otherwise. The warmth of her hand comforts him now, and he tells himself that maybe things will turn out all right. They will leave the country and start over in a new place together with the children, in a matchbox apartment in a Manhattan high-rise, or in an anonymous clapboard house in an American suburb, where people will mispronounce their names and where they will eventually stop correcting them, laughing instead at the botched words. And then I'll read another excerpt. Here they just received a letter from the brother, Javad, who has safely made it to Paris, and is informing them. Farnaz reads the letter twice before running to the bedroom, where Isaac is placing a handful of gemstones in a pouch. "Isaac, a letter from Javad. He's in Paris. He has an apartment in Montmartre." "That devil," Isaac laughs. "No doubt he got himself an apartment there to be close to the cabarets." "Ah, that little devil," he says again, and his face opens up, a hint of playfulness returning to his eyes. "We're next, Farnaz, John, we're next." "Yes, we're next." The escape assembly line, people waiting their turn to cross the border and settle like dust on the world map. If we leave this country without taking care of our belongings, who in Geneva or Paris or Timbuktu will understand who we once were, Shahla had once asked. And perhaps she was right, after all. Even if they make it across the border, Farnaz wonders, what will become of them on the other side? "Mustafa is bringing the rest of the payment for the house this afternoon," Isaac says. "He's better. He's getting this house at a bargain, that opportunist. You should be happy if you've even managed to sell it in such a short time." "Yes, I'm happy, but the house is worth at least 5 times the price you settled on." He throws the pouch on the bed. "The price I settled on? You think I had a choice? We're leaving, Farnaz. What part of that don't you understand? We're leaving in 2 weeks. You should be happy we got a buyer at all. Those smugglers, they're calling me every day asking for the money, and I tell them it's coming, it's coming." "All right, you don't need to yell." "But I do," he says, walking to the bathroom and splashing his face with water. "I do need to yell, because I can't take it anymore." Hunched over the sink, he looks at his wet face in the mirror. "I don't have much left in me," he says, calmer now. If it weren't for you and the children, I would probably just stay and wait out my final years with my mother. What final years? What has gotten into you? You're not even 60. I will be in a couple of years. You have many years ahead of you, so stop talking like an old man. She sits on the bed and opens the pouch, freeing the stones on the blue satin bedspread against which they sparkle. She runs her hand over them, their hard, still unpolished edges pricking her skin. You think I really want to go? So now you don't want to go? You're the one who kept insisting, remember? What are you saying? I'm saying what you're saying, that I don't want to go, but that I will go, because I have no other choice. Somehow I don't have the right to say that, do I? Coming from me, it sounds like ingratitude, but I am tired also, and like you, I've lost much. She pushes the stones and lies down on the bed. The heat persists despite the air conditioners working at full capacity. She watches him, still hunched over the sink, looking down. She realizes that her husband will from now on have the monopoly on grief for the simple, inarguable fact that he has been in prison, that he has faced death many times over, and has seen and heard others die. Her own unhappiness, negligible next to his, will have to be suppressed if they are to continue their lives together, because there is simply not enough space between them for that much sorrow. She hears him crying now, the way he had the night he heard of Kurosh Nasiri's execution. She lies on the bed and listens without interrupting him. She leaves the house, knowing that when she returns, it will no longer be theirs. She drives for a long time, her hands shaky on the wheel, the sun on the windshield blinding her. Everyone's story must come to an end, she knows, but to prepare for the end that they have, to liquidate one's belongings and sign over the deed to one's house, is not unlike selecting a casket, lying in it voluntarily, and shutting it from inside. She stops the car to run one final errand, returning the 16th century miniature to Javad's friend. The thought of spending some time in the shop, surrounded by antiques, comforts her, and she tells herself that if Shahriyar Beheshti is not busy, she'll stay for a while and have a cup of tea with him. But when she arrives, she finds the store empty and shut. She walks up and down the street looking for it, mistrusting her memory of the exact location. Are you looking for Beheshti? A carpet seller smoking outside his shop calls out. Yes, he closed. You mean he was closed, the man says, walking toward her. In a lowered voice, he continues, they came after him to Hanum. They seized everything, all his antiques, the poor man. And when he started protesting, they blindfolded him and took him away in a van. She peers inside the shop through the glass. Nothing is left but dusty shelves and a glass filled with turbid tea on the counter, along with a half-eaten sandwich, surrounded now by ants, Shahriyar Beheshti's final lunch. Looks like they got him recently. Yes, just last week. She thanks the man and walks away, the painting still tucked under her arm. She decides to take it with her on the trip. Like them, the antiques dealer may one day cross the border and show up in America, where he may look for them, or in Paris, where he may run into Javad at a sidewalk cafe. She would return it to him then, and he would hold on to it. And he would hold it, this painted sheet that will no doubt become as dear to him as a lost child, the only item to remind him of times past. So that's the reading from this book. And now I'll read some excerpts from the book I'm currently working on, which is still very much in progress. It's called, for now, The Sound Man of Tehran. And this one is a story of a man who... This one is a story of a man who grew up in Tehran's Jewish quarter in the 1920s, and he emigrates to Paris in the 30s, where he has a rather misguided youth and decides to return to the city of his birth in 1952 with his young son. He has lost his wife, Alexandra. Tehran, Shahrazad Street, 1952. To go somewhere, you need foresight. To go back somewhere, you need memory. I had lost both. I stood in the Tehran railway station, my back to the train tracks. A clock above the ticket booth announced the time, 12 minutes past 3. A board displaying gates and departures rewrote itself every few seconds. I held my son's limp wrist in one hand, and in the other I carried my suitcase dented in the front like a mouth with knocked out teeth. The full reality of life without Alexandra unveiled itself to me at last, and were it not for Daniel's sighs potting me on, I would have dropped the suitcase and signed off. Dayenu, as my father used to say. We made our way out of the station and into the summer afternoon, and we rode a bus to Shahrazad Street, where I had rented a space, having hastily made all the arrangements by mail from Paris. I worried now that the space I had been promised on paper would not be there. As the bus trotted along, I brought my son's sleeping head closer to my chest. His hair smelled of sweat and unwashed dread. We had come a long way. We had boarded a train to Marseille, sailed along the Mediterranean onto the Aegean, disembarked in Izmir, ridden a bus to Istanbul, and a train to Tehran. Along the way, we had seen businessmen and diplomats, returning students and missing sons, tourists hoping to return with brag-worthy photographs of their exploits. On the ship, seasick and sleepless, I had stood on deck and watched the silver light of a full moon on the black water. I thought of my parents, my city, my language, the room facing the willow tree. Where, I wondered, did I forget them? Crossing which border, in what administration office, drinking which cocktail, did I lose them? Having trained myself to look forward, I had disremembered what looking back entailed. Through the dusty bus window, I now watched the city transformed in the 15 years of my absence. Ruins had become boulevards, cemeteries were turned into parks. I wondered where the bones had gone. Along the new avenues, shops boasted silk ties and slingback shoes and borsalino hats, and buildings with stucco decorations and small turrets were now home to the affluent class that had abandoned their sun-dried brick shacks in the old neighborhoods. We got off the bus and made our way to our designated address, a clean, white, three-story house. A velvet pouch containing a key hung on the front door with a note, "Esteemed Mohandes, welcome. Please find your way up to the second floor and make yourself at home, Reza Taghi Buzurgi." To be referred to as Mohandes startled me, as I had recently and very belatedly earned my engineering degree in Paris. I tucked the note in my pocket and opened the front door. We entered a sun-filled sitting room, cushioned and carpeted, and walked up the stairs to our floor, where we found a small bedroom and a bathroom with a Persian toilet and a clawfoot porcelain tub. Connected to it was a matchbox kitchen with a portable gas stove, which reminded me of my first studio in Paris when I had just arrived there as a 17-year-old engineering student carrying a small suitcase and grand ideas for my future. Our bedroom looked out onto a garden with a fig tree, a mulberry tree, and two lush willows that struck me with violent wistfulness, reminding me of my boyhood. As the window was high up, I lifted Daniel in my arms so he could also look out, but he remained indifferent to the view until he spotted a stray orange cat and his eyes lit up. It was then that I understood that the child was captive to his own retrieved memory, our dear cat Leopold, whom we had left behind in Paris. "Leopold," Daniel said. He freed himself from my arms and ran. A few minutes later, as I saw him approaching the stunned animal in the garden, I told myself that the demarcation line between deception and hope was tenuous, and there were times such as this when one had to cross that line in order to carry on. He cradled the cat and returned to the house. "I knew Leopold wouldn't forget us," he said, resting his hollow cheek against the cat's white whiskers. "And you were right," I said. "He didn't forget." We washed and sat at our makeshift kitchen table, a stool covered with a yellow cotton cloth. Around it were two short wooden chairs, one of them rickety. On the table, Reza Taghi had left us a thoughtful meal, fresh bread, cheese, milk, and a bowl of ripe figs. tea in a samovar was ready on another stool next to it, along with two clean glass cups and a silver tin of sugar cubes. Though I was moved by the arrangement, by the attempt at cheerfulness, I felt I was in the toy version of a house that a man my age, well past 30, should be living in. I remembered the shimmering dollhouses in the window displays of the Parisian department stores during Christmas, sprinkled with glitter and make-believe snowflakes, those opulent dollhouses Alexandra loved so much, and which she made me promise we would one day buy for our yet-to-be-conceived daughter. Alexandra was not sure about many things, but her destiny to bear a daughter was her one certainty. She had even selected a name for this girl child, Gerson. Do you expect me to tell my poor parents that I've named a daughter of mine Gerson, I would say? Your parents, she would say. If it were up to them, you would be in some dingy atelier in South Tehran, chiseling an unoriginal epitaph on a grave. That her slights regarding my parents offended me was beside the point. What pained me was that often they were exaggerations of the very things I had confided in her. I was the first to admit that my parents were tribal and myopic, my father known as the stonecutter of the Jewish cemetery, and my mother the superstitious fortune-telling matron of our neighborhood. And yet, I also knew that it was those same individuals who had enrolled me in the city's first French school for Jewish children, though they themselves were barely literate. To diffuse my anger and steer the conversation to a more neutral zone, I would tease Alexandra that Gerson sounded like a character out of Molière. All the better, she would say. Molière is France's national pride. Once, when my dejection was too intense for me to mask it, she conceded. All right, mon trésor, she said. This was what she often called me, my treasure. If we have a son, I'll let you pick his name from one of your national epics, or worse, from the Old Testament. Daniel hungrily grabbed a fig from the bowl and bit into it, the juice spilling on his chin, catching him off guard. I handed him my handkerchief, monogrammed AK for Aaron Khan, a gift from Alexandra, then sat him down in the good chair and prepared a sandwich for him, remembering the dark kitchen of our Paris apartment during the many blackouts and the candlelit wooden table where I had fed the boy so many meals when he was a baby, coaxing him to open his mouth by pretending the spoon was an airplane. Blitz, blitz, open up, I would say. Blitzkrieg for baby. As Daniel and I settled into our new lives, the orange cat, Leopold's double, erased for my son the interruptions we had endured and the borders we had crossed. I envied his eight-year-old mind for the mirages it was willing to accept, and to emulate him I looked, relentlessly and in vain, for reflections of the life I had built and lost. And the final excerpt I'll read comes a little later in the novel. Here I should mention that the man is named, his real name is Harun Hakim, but in France he had changed his name to Aaron Khan. He has rented a kiosk from a Jewish businessman named Benjamin Davoud, and he's starting an electronics repair business, which is somewhat below what he had hoped he would one day be doing. Other kiosks in the shop belong to Benjamin, a tailor, Shemuel, a clockmaker, and Asher, an eyeglass seller. I settled into the kiosk in Benjamin Davoud's shop. The sign I had ordered was delivered to me 2 weeks later, bearing the words Khan Electronics Company, the chosen name of my enterprise. For some time, I had hesitated about the name, Hakim or Khan, but in the end, I had chosen Khan, as that had been my moniker during my years in Europe, and besides, that was how I had been known to Alexandra, and eventually to myself. I had the name printed in Persian and English, and for the Latin font, I chose Garamond, the typeface of my beloved series of books, Pleiad, those leather-bound golden scribed tomes that had begun appearing on Parisian bookshelves a few years prior to my arrival. It was Alexandra who had introduced me to these books, each a compendium of one writer's complete works so dense that it was printed on Bible-thin paper and inspired, perhaps for this reason, a kind of religious veneration. At least in me, the boy who had until then only viewed the stardust of French letters through an opaque telescope from Tehran's Jewish quarter. I may have been regarded as a Gaelic prince back home, but in Paris, I suddenly found myself a non-entity, an anonymous newcomer from a forgotten world lying invisibly eastward. I was eager to change my status, and the Pléiade soon became my ticket out of Nantes. And so I read Racine and Voltaire and Balzac, trying to make up for the lost hours of my existence, and I read with devotion all of Molière as a way to bond with Alexandra, but also to show my gratitude to her for introducing me to a world that would always hover beyond my grasp. That I did not understand much of what I read did not trouble me. I believed that, as in a spiritual education, the essence of the words would permeate my being, even if their exact meaning eluded me. I placed the sign high above my kiosk, where it hung with dignity above the fray of the shop, the Garamond letters uncluttered and noble, the hollows of the A's and the mandorlas of the E's curving against the serifs that stood slender and restrained like the upper foliage of a Mediterranean cypress. The other shopkeepers, Shemuel the clockmaker and Asher the eyeglass seller, and of course Benjamin Davoud himself, all eyed me with a certain curiosity bearing on suspicion. I knew that they dismissed my movements as unfortunate mannerisms I had collected during my years abroad, and perhaps they were right. When one lives on alien land, one adopts alien habits and eventually returns with alien memories. Over the course of the first few weeks, I collected broken radios and gramophones from neighbors and acquaintances. I even sifted through garbage dumps for abandoned electronics, tying a handkerchief around my nose and mouth to protect myself from the stench, and wearing a pair of tattered gloves I had worn throughout the winter of 1942 in Paris, when my world had begun splintering. I dissected my finds to remove functional pieces that I then inventoried as spare parts to be used for eventual repairs. This strategy worked. When customers started arriving with short circuits and dysfunctional capacitors, I had a full arsenal of parts to mend their machines. Soon I developed a reputation as an ingenious repairman, a fact that raised my standing among my fellow shopkeepers, who no longer viewed me as the fussy and pretentious Francophile, but as an industrious Jew whom they now proudly considered one of their own. My feeling toward them moved in the opposite direction. While in the beginning I had been eager for their approval, going out of my way to engage in pleasantries when I arrived in the morning and bringing them small offerings I had picked up along the way, a box of Danish sweets or a bag of pistachios, I now found myself irritated by them. Toward Shemuel, a discreet learned man in his 70s with a white beard and a skullcap who spent his free time reading the Talmud, I felt a quiet tenderness. But Asher and Benjamin had ways about them that drove me to the edge of myself. They were both middle-aged, noisy, and spoke with a drawl characteristic of certain Jews who rose from the Mahalleh. In their appearance, too, they were unkempt. Even Benjamin, who could create the latest creased pants and double-breasted jackets for his customers, but himself wore an overused woolen pair of trousers held up with safety pins and a tunic he must have at one time worn in bed. But beyond all aesthetic manners, it was their tribalism that grated me, their insistence to keep themselves apart. Over time, I grew more quiet and withdrawn, and rarely did I engage in the banter around me. I wrote this off to lack of time, as in fact my clientele was steadily growing. Toward my fellow shopkeepers, I acted detached and businesslike, a behavior that they seemed to encourage, as they themselves had begun considering me superior to them, and therefore beyond their petty interruptions. It was Shemuel who walked to my booth one afternoon and said, "Business is good, Mohandas?" "Thank God," I said, as I continued completing the accounts payable column in my book. "It's good." "Baruch Hashem," he said, the Hebrew term for what I had just said. "But don't let it run your life," he added. I stopped writing and looked up. I had rarely been this close to him. The whites of his eyes were chalky, making him look even more ethereal. "You," he continued, "who have seen the worst in Europe, don't turn your back on your own." "I have great affection for you, Shemuel," I said. "I know, but I am not enough," he said. "Have affection for the others, too. You may dress better and speak better and even think better, but you are no better. You can't be, since they too are a part of you." I nodded to indicate I had understood, and he walked away back to the broken clocks in his kiosk, each stuck at a different hour. I contemplated what he had said. My head, heavy all morning, began throbbing. I looked at Benjamin and Asher from the corner of my eye. Why were they my own? What had we in common, other than ancestors once held captive in Babylon? I had spent my life better in my mind, thinking about the world around me. What had these men done, other than lament and write off their misery to fate? I had indeed witnessed the wars in Europe, and that fact alone, I believed, gave me the privilege to consider myself a man with free will and not a marionette beholden to history. Benjamin, pouring himself a glass of tea, noticed me looking at him and smiled. "Everything all right, Mohandas?" "Fine," I said, "just feeling tired." "You work too hard," he said, as he walked over to my kiosk and placed the tea on my counter. He walked away again and returned with a few sugar cubes that he slid cautiously on the saucer. Again, I noticed his immaculate fingernails, so unlike the rest of him. "Take a little rest," he said. "You're very young still and should pace yourself. It's a long road, believe me," he laughed. "I've already found this out and I'm only halfway there." I thanked him for the tea. I placed the sugar cube under my tongue and sipped, the sweet granules dissolving in my mouth and the tang of cardamom and bergamot soothing my head. My distress now intermingled with guilt, a familiar place. I watched Benjamin resettle behind his sewing machine, stooped in his chair and unclaimed by the world, and I began grieving, maybe for the first time, the years I had spent away from my past.
Thank you so much, Dahlia. I wanted to explore some themes that you write in your books. For example, when we're looking at the Septembers of Shiraz on page 302, you talk about Isaac and his wife Farnaz, and they're contemplating leaving Iran. They know they will never return to Iran, that the Iran of their past, of the Pahlavi monarchy, westernization, secularization, will no longer exist. And you describe the sterile suburban world of America that Isaac assumes he will move to, where people will mispronounce his Persian name and the poetic Persian language. Why do you focus on the theme of pain and the theme of exile? What about that interests you in your writing?
Well, exile is a topic that preoccupies me, as it no doubt does everyone who has left their home. An exile is different from an immigrant in that an exile has not chosen to leave but has left by necessity. And this forced departure creates a kind of displacement that goes beyond issues of cultural adaptation and so on. It's a displacement in time and place, so that one is simultaneously in the present but also living in a kind of past. And one is in this strange alternate realities at once, the present and again the life that is and the life that could have been. To me, exile is a constant collision with an absence. And it's trying to move forward, even as one is constantly slipping into a kind of void. But, you know, this is the most literal definition of exile, is the geographic exile. But of course, exile is a human condition, it's man's separation from his society. And that's probably the theme, that the aspect of exile that interests me even more than the literal one. And, you know, in the book, for example, September, you could say that Isaac's exile begins on page one, when he is arrested and extracted from his society, and it culminates in his actual literal exile on the final page. But in between, it's this sort of growing alienation from the person he has been, the person, the life he has led, and it's his reckoning with this dichotomy. And one other way that I try to explore exile in this book, it's by telling the story through four points of view. So all the different family members get their own chapters, and they are very much, each one is encapsulated in his or her own section, and rarely do they communicate on the page except in memory. And that was another way to explore the theme of exile. It's the exile of pain, of suffering that one is left with, when it's that acute, that one is left with in isolation.
Do you think that, you know, this dual identity that Iranians in exile have, whether they live in Europe, whether they live in America, do you think this theme of exile or this memory is easier for Iranian Muslims who tend to have more of the luxury of going back and forth to Iran as opposed to the Jews, Baha'is, Christians? Do you think it's a different experience when you could, you're not really exiled, but you could go back to visit, as opposed to religious minorities who are truly in exile?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a fact that it is easier for Muslim Iranians to go back and forth, unless that Muslim Iranian happens to be an artist or writer or political activist or so on. At the same time, I would say that, well, also I want to differentiate between the minorities, because the Jews, for example, aren't persecuted systematically the way that the Baha'is are, for example. So the Jews are recognized, even though they are second class, in some ways, second class citizens. At the same time, you know, despite the external markers, I would say that exile at the end, the sense of exile at the end of the day is a very individual feeling, and so a lot of it also depends on one's upbringing and one's place in the family and just one's sense of belonging to the world. So I don't know that it's easy for one group or another. The other thing I would say is exile in relation to the home country as opposed to exile in relation to the host country. So while it might be easier for Muslim Iranians to go back and forth, right now with the current climate, being a Muslim is not the easiest thing. And so their sense of belonging to the host country is compromised. And so I don't know that anyone has it easy, I guess.
And I think that's what's so great about your book, is that that theme of exile is so appropriate for what's going on today in the news and what we're seeing going on all over the Middle East. Another aspect that you talk about is the monopoly on suffering. And what we see throughout the book is that people are constantly, their property is constantly being seized by the government or by the people who supported Khomeini, who tended to come from a lower socioeconomic, more religious background, who all of a sudden Isaac goes to his beach house and there's a man living there. He says, "No, well, this is mine. I support Khomeini, I suffered under the Shah, you didn't deserve this house, I now deserve your house." How does that play that theme of suffering? Because we see everyone believes that they have the monopoly on suffering.
It's been documented that the Pahlavi regime was not a just one. And while many benefited, Jews included, many more did not. And so, it's a common outcome of revolutions that those who feel they have been oppressed seek revenge on their oppressors. And often they do this with a kind of entitlement and moral higher ground. I mean, the French Revolution is a great example of this, and the Reign of Terror that followed. I always think of something that encapsulates this is a painting by Jacques-Louis David of The Death of Marat, Maha was an associate of Robespierre, who was the henchman of the French Revolution, and he was assassinated in his bathtub. And the way David, if you are familiar with this painting, the way David depicts him is with this kind of almost religious, you know, Maha was a henchman himself, but it's with this kind of religious overtones. And some have even suggested that his body is reminiscent of Christ. And so I think revolutionaries often do believe that they have this kind of moral higher ground and almost a divine message. And it's no different in this revolution, where they believed in the cause and they believed that they were entitled.
While acting incredibly corrupt in the process.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And for many people, they did not want to leave because they knew they were going to lose everything, their home, their business, their antiques. And you have passages in which people said, we leave and who's going to know who we are? Who's ever going to know about our lives? And that hindered a lot of people from leaving because they just didn't want to start all over again. Especially in a society where, like, it is based on a lot of material possessions and what you have. Can you discuss and define for people the concept of aberu in Persian society and how it affects Persian society?
So aberu is an interesting term. The closest translation I can come up with is saving face.
Right.
Ru is face. You know, home and possessions are important in many cultures, as possessions reflect their owner's wealth and status and pedigree and taste, etc. But in Persian society, you're right, it is very important. I think also because the idea, a home is not just a place to live, it's also a place where you receive. The idea of receiving guests is very important. And so this notion of receiving guests as a double play. One is really to honor the guests, but the other one is to showcase your status in a highly hierarchical society, and it sort of sets the pecking order, like, this is, you know, you're in my home. And to lose that is really to lose your aberu, is to lose your face, because your home is this sort of connection to your society. And I think, you know, when you think of the term aberu, the opposite of it, aberu dizikerdan, is losing face. The literal translation would be to shred somebody's face or facade. And there's a kind of violence almost in the language. It's that intense to lose your face. So I think home and possessions are very much connected to that kind of reputation of saving face.
I wanted to ask you, how much of this book and Isaac Amin's story is autobiographical for you?
It was inspired by true events, but it's not my actual life. I'll just say that I was a child during the revolution. My father was imprisoned, but not under the circumstances that I put Isaac in. We did run away through Turkey eventually. So some things are autobiographical, but it is largely fictional too, in that I did a lot of research and turned to my imagination and so on to create a different narrative. It's not my story, but it's inspired by.
You have a lot of details about life being imprisoned in Yvonne prison. Where did you find the research on all of that from?
Different places. I spoke to my father first and foremost, and he was able to give me amazing details.
It wasn't psychologically hard for him to talk about it?
Not under the right circumstances, and we found the right circumstances, which I'm grateful for. But other than that, there are many, many accounts on the internet. I mean, you would be surprised how many accounts there are. I found a recording somewhere of a interrogation session. So Yeah, which was harrowing to listen to. But there are sources available. I mean, many people have undergone, that sadly, many people have gone through this experience. So,
is your book in Iran? Do people in Iran, do they have the opportunity to read it? And what does the government think of it? Do you know?
Well, not officially. So I don't have an official response. I guess I'll leave it to that.
Okay, let's get to the new book that you wrote, that you're working on. And it looks at the identity of grieving your past and coming to terms with your future and the people that you left behind. Can you talk about some of the themes in this book that you're working on about exile, return, identity, and community? In a sense, your main character is embarrassed by the Jews of the Mahalle, the Jewish ghetto, and then realizes how much he has judged them and that he truly does come from that world.
Yeah. Well, this is a man in this book, King, is a man who's trying to understand who he is. And in order to do that, he has to go back to and see where he comes from. Now, paradoxically, the institution that sort of saved him from the poverty and misery of the Mahalle, of the Jewish quarter, the Alliance school, the French school, ends up driving him away from his home and himself in some ways. But eventually this departure is what causes him to really want to examine himself and his community and his past, and he returns. He is somebody who has, from a young age, studied the sort of very French ideals of the Voltairean Republic, and he tries to fashion himself as this modern, secular man. But the question throughout the book remains, can such a man, sort of severed from community and collective memory, truly exist? And he's sort of constantly trying to find his way through the book.
And then finally, just the theme of the Iranian Jewish community. It has been one of the oldest communities in the diaspora. It's about 2,700 years old. And a majority of the community has escaped Iran, and with Los Angeles having the largest Iranian Jewish community, New York having the second, there's maybe at most 10,000 Jews left in Iran. So my question is, how does the community maintain its identity in exile while they're basically in another diaspora, and what is next for the Iranian community?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, as you say, the history of Iranian Jews is rich and long, and it dates back to the time of Cyrus, who freed the slaves of Babylon and allowed them to go back and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, and many returned and many stayed in what eventually became the Persian Empire. Throughout the centuries, the fortune of the Jews waxed and waned, but it's important to say that they've remained a presence, and that's not true for many places in the world. My father is originally from Iraq, and he fled Baghdad during the pogroms of Rashid Ali. And some 10 years ago, I was reading an article that said that there were about 10 Jews left in Iraq, and one of them was a 90-something-year-old man with the last name Sofer. And it sort of, it taps into that anxiety I have about vanishing societies, and I fear that the same fate may await the Iranian Jews, even though they've stayed all this time. They are dwindling. I mean, just, the figure you quote is a recent one. I've even seen lower figures, like 8,600 or something. Up until a few years ago, they were saying 25,000. So they are leaving. What to do about it is complicated, but I think, for the diaspora community, I think we have certain possibly superficial ways of staying connected to the culture. So say we'll have a Persian parade, but I mean, we have that in New York, I'm sure you guys have it in Los Angeles. And while it's wonderful to be surrounded by other Iranians, to see float after float of people dressed as Cyrus and Darius and, you know, the sort of great kings of the Persian Empire leaves you wondering a little bit, like, it feels a bit possibly nationalistic and empty at the end of the day. So I think, you know, each person has to examine what does it mean to be an Iranian Jew, what is its inherent value, and is it worth preserving? And more I'm coming to the conclusion that it has something to do with staying connected to the language, because I think while we've maintained possibly a lot of other things, a lot of people are losing a deep connection to at least the written language and the real literature. And so when you lose your language, you've essentially lost your home. And I think that might be a saving grace. The other thing is that there is a great schism between the Jewish community in Iran and the Persian Jewish community outside. It's almost like they're separate societies. And my hope is that as the West and Iran are starting to communicate, that will extend to the Jewish community, because really it's like two separate entities.
I know I'm biased, but I do commend the Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies, because we do offer Iranian Jewish history classes as a way of really preserving that identity, as my students here know. So I will open it up for discussion for any questions that anyone would have for Dalia. Are there any questions? Yes. Can you stand up? Thank you, Tova.
Hi. Our professor said that you went to a French school in New York. So did you do that? Was that because you were in an academy in Iran beforehand?
Yeah, in Iran I was in the Liceo Azadi. And when I came to New York, I didn't speak English, so French was the next best thing. So yeah, we continued in the French school.
Did I see a hand up? Yes.
One of the things that when people go, either immigrate or go to exile, is that they lose their position, the thing that they, it was their identity. And when they come here, they can't have that position there, especially if they haven't come with a lot of money or just they came here with the skill that they had in Iran. For example, I was teaching at the university when I was in Iran as a nurse. I had my master's degree from Boston University, went back, teach at the university, but when I came here, I had to go and be a bedside nurse, start from zero almost. I think that is something that people, it pains people, a lot of people, especially after revolution, a lot of people who had high position in shops or in the government, they came here and had nothing. I had patients who were so depressed, but they couldn't go back either. Have you noticed?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a character in the book who's in a similar, he's a small character, but he's in a similar situation where, so yeah, I mean, absolutely, it's a tragedy of people leaving where it's not just about possessions.
What's the question?
So the question was.
I have a question.
We were just going to repeat that question, and then we'll get to your ask. So the question was this idea of when you leave and you leave all your possession, you leave your status, you leave your degree, and then you have to start all over again. And that sense of it causing emotional distress, depression, as we see with a lot of people that came here and had to start all over again in this foreign country, and then also knowing you could never go back, that there's this idea that it's not as if your life is there waiting for you. And so the question was, if I said this correctly, did you experience any of that, or have you seen any of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's prevalent. And it's a little bit what I was trying to get at with how I perceive exile, which is sort of being, it's displacement in time and place. Mm-hmm. So you are here, but you're really somewhere else too, because you've lost your agency.
Yes.
How would you compare the Holocaust survivors to the Iranian immigrants, whatever you call them, exiles?
So the question was, how do you compare Holocaust survivors to Iranian exiles?
The adjustment process.
I don't think that, I mean, as horrible as all the experiences have been of Iranians, I don't think it's anywhere on the level of the Holocaust, and I don't want to compare the two because it's just not, it's not the same.
It's not. I have another question. Can I ask you?
Rose, yes, you can ask me a
question.
Yes, please go ahead.
Yeah. Well, but how come that I'm a Holocaust survivor, and I'm in a very, I was in a very similar position what Iranian Jews went through. But when we came to America, my parents were in their 50s, and we tried to adjust to the life that Americans live. And we went through just as much, you know, we had things, and but we adjusted and we made our lives here. And I'm raising my children, and I'm very happy. That they gave me the opportunity to save, that I was saved with my parents, and I can have a family on my own and raise them.
So the question is
there's a question, yes. How come that the Holocaust survivors did not feel the same way? That they were, you know, they left their homes, they had families. I'm not talking about killings. We lived well, and we came as immigrants, and we had to make our new lives here. And we did. And we are, you know, just like I feel very American. I don't feel that I'm Polish. Or whatever I live.
I would just respond.
Can I just say something? I mean, I don't know what the comparison is. Holocaust survivors' lives were shattered. Their countries were destroyed. Their lives, their villages and the cities were destroyed. They have nowhere to go except here. You can't compare that to the Persians. The Persians left the Iranians left the life that they had. The Holocaust survivors left a life that was decimated. They had to come here and make a life here. They had nowhere else to go. I don't know what the comparison is.
Well, I think the theme of leaving, starting all over again, and knowing that you can never go back to what you once had, because it no longer exists.
Exactly.
It no longer exists.
But at the same time, Iranians have established a life here, you know, and so, yeah, we talk about exile and so on, but they, you know, carried on, and they, you know, they have jobs, and they have families, and they, you know, they have made a life here, and so it's not like everybody's sitting smoking opium and saying, you know, why are we in exile? You know, it's not like that, but the pain remains. I mean, you know, the pain of the absence remains.
Sarah?
I have two related questions. The first is, both of the readings, first were very beautiful, thank you. Mm-hmm. The reading from your work in progress, it strikes me that it is such a rare motif, either in Jewish literature with a Jewish theme, or in scholarship that attends to Jewish themes. It's so rare to talk about the person who returns. It's so ubiquitous, the story of departure is so ubiquitous. But of course, many people, for various reasons, had to go back. Maybe they couldn't succeed, you know, maybe they missed their home, maybe they had to tend to family matters. And there is an untold story about those who return, and here you, are speaking, we don't know all the details, of course, but you're speaking about a sort of counterintuitive story of return. And I wonder if you could comment on that. And the related question is to move us a little bit from the sort of sociological to the literary. I'm curious if this shift from a moment of pre-departure, of psychic preparation for departure in September, as to your new project about coming to terms with being back. I wonder how you navigated that in terms of voice, and whether you are self-consciously using different literary strategies to parallel or signal that transition from the first project to the ongoing one.
You should be a professor here.
Well, to answer your first question about returning, the idea of returning, I think that's probably because it's been my own preoccupation with the idea of returning. It's a wish that I have, and while I may not be able to execute it right now, it's a deep desire that I have. And so one way to visit it was to do it in fiction. And also, you know, like the final word of this book is elsewhere. You know, they're sort of looking, imagining different waters elsewhere. And a few years have passed since, and, you know, I'm starting to look at, okay, this was elsewhere, and let me go back. You know, I think it's a highly personal thing for me. But, I mean, you know, there have been people who have written about return. I'm thinking of Cesare Calese, the Italian writer, the Moon on a Bonfire, where he returns to his home village. And that's always an interesting thing to, you know, to return. Now, in terms of the voice, I don't know that I'm consciously doing something different. This one is coming to me in the first person very immediately. Did that. And maybe because, again, it's my own preoccupation with the return, and so I'm writing it in first. Beyond that, you know, it isn't, I don't know yet. I don't know yet.
Alexandra.
Hi. I wanted to ask a personal question. When you came to the United States, did you feel a need to dissociate from your Iranian identity in order to assimilate better into your community that you were familiar with? Or did you feel that you could be Iranian and be accepted by your Jewish society or your secular society?
So the question was, when Dahlia came to the United States, did she disassociate from her Iranian identity, or did she feel comfortable to be able to have both?
Well, because I was a child, I wasn't really that aware of what I was doing. And I think as a child or you know, preteen or whatever, you kind of want to integrate, probably, you know, regardless. The question came to me later, probably in my 20s, and I think the older I got, the more comfortable I became with, and then the more I began to really embrace it, but not as a kind of nationalistic thing, but as something that really means, you know, it is something that means something to me. It's an attachment that means something. It's not just, so I think with time it became more developed.
What was the
reconnected to.
Yes.
I'm sort of halfway in the middle. I was born in Germany. My father was in prison and had to leave the country in 1938, leaving there an affluent lifestyle and coming here. And my mother, instead of having cooks, became a cleaning girl. So I sort of understand a little bit of that transition. But the difference being, I think, is that my parents on weekends were German, if you will, with their society or whatever. And during the week, they made a tremendous effort to integrate and to accommodate the American way and things of this sort. I don't always get the feeling, or I do get a feeling, that the Iranian society, the Jewish society, has tried to make an effort to remain outside of the American society, with not necessarily integrating, possibly during work and things of this sort, but being separate. as German Jewish refugees made effort to integrate? And do you feel the same? Do you feel this is happening? Or?
Maybe I'll leave that to you because you've studied the Persian community a lot more.
I wrote a book on Iranian Jewish women, and so I interviewed about 120, ages 90 to 18. And teaching for as long as I have, I think what happened with the Iranian Jewish community is, number one, is what we call the suitcase mentality. The Iran of the Pahlavis was this very secular, very modernized Iran. They refer to it as the Paris of the Middle East. Of course, people in Lebanon refer to Beirut as the Paris of the Middle East, so they all have their Paris of the Middle East that they compete with. But it was this very secular country. It had the support, the number one support of America. And so I think I was young, and I almost want to ask every Iranian sitting here, but I think from my interviews and what people said was, we were just in disbelief that this country that was so secular and so modernized and so Europeanized, etc., would go back to almost the 16th century ideology of Shia Islam, that this secular Shah is going to be overturned by a man with a beard down to his knees. And so I think what a lot of Iranians thought, again, there were people who thought they were going to come here right before, so they were planning on moving to America. But I think for a lot of Iranians, it took a really long time when they came here to accept that they're never going back. They were just waiting for the Iranians or for America, whether it was Carter, and you talk to Iranians, it's always, everything was Carter's fault,
or the British.
The Carter and the British were, they were waiting for Carter and then Reagan to just go back in and support the Shah, who at this point is now running from one country to another because no one would bring him in. And more importantly, I think they thought that how can Iranians want this government? And so I think 1 year turned into three, turned into five, turned into 10. And then people realized, okay, we kind of have to get our clothes out of the suitcase and start hanging them up and start becoming a part of the community. And I do think that, for example, Iranian Jews in Los Angeles are more insular than Iranians in New York and other places. And I think a lot of the reason why is that there's such a large community here that they could afford to only communicate and be with each other. Not that that excuses it, but that you could easily live right next door to your mother, down the street from your sister. All of your family goes to the same Jewish day school. You have 50 people a Shabbat. And so you could easily just be amongst your friends and family and never have to acculturate. And this is something, I mean, you're absolutely right, because this is something that the synagogues are dealing with, the day schools are dealing with. Nina?
The other factor is that when the Germans came to the United States, it was in the 40s and 50s, and America was very European. Whereas when the Iranians came to the United States, it was accepted to have your own ethnic groups, and it allowed them to have their own ethnic community. It was not like when my husband, who's American, when his father, they couldn't speak Yiddish at home because they were supposed to Americanize. Whereas the generation of the 70s, they were allowed to, it was better to keep the language and your identity. There's a Korean town, there's a Vietnamese town, there's a Westwood Persian town. It's more the culture is allowing to have your own cultures. Whereas in the early 50s and late 40s, you weren't allowed to speak Yiddish publicly. You were supposed to
assimilate and be a part of
the culture. Whereas now it's okay to have both cultures.
Yes.
Americans are all descendants of immigrants. All of us, if we go back far enough, or maybe not so far, will find immigrants. And the immigrants were exiles. And the exiles experienced many of the same things that you're talking about. So it's not an unfamiliar subject. My question is, do you think, based upon what you think, do you think that the themes that you raise are universal, so that when we read your book, we can read it in the context that this is a human story, not a Persian story, not an American story, but a human story? Or do you think that there is something unique in the Persian experience? And if you think that's the case, I'd like to know what it is, because I know what the Germans Americans think. I know what the Russian Americans think. I know what the Vietnamese Americans think. But I don't know any Persians.
Well, for me, it is a universal tradition. And like I said, you know, the exile to me is not just geographic. It's also that sense of alienation, which is truly universal. I mean, you can argue that from the moment somebody is born, they're sent into exile because they're banished from the mother's womb. So, yes, to me, it's now each particular story does have its own particularities. Each situation has its, the political aspects, what the people underwent before leaving. So some left under economic hardship, some left because of imprisonment, you know, so each situation is different and in that way probably affects the psyche of that population. But I would say that the overall experience to me is universal. Yeah.
Yes.
My question was about the influence of your father. It looks like he had to be exiled twice in his lifetime. How much did that affect your perspective and obviously conversations with that?
The question was about my father, who has in fact been exiled twice. He ran away twice, and how that affected, I guess, us and our family, or me in particular. I think it leaves a kind of taste of impermanence constantly, because to be unsettled twice in one lifetime is sort of, it's a lot. And it just leaves, yeah, it leaves a kind of precariousness that one is constantly aware of. I don't know that I was that aware of it before the revolution. I didn't think that much about where my father came. I mean, I was very young, so I didn't really think that much about where he came from. But at the same time, you know, he spoke Arabic, so there was this kind of other, you know, aspect in the household that I was aware of. Yeah, and it probably, you know, connects to the larger Jewish question of having to be on the move, or possibly having to be on the move. So sort of always having a suitcase ready just in case.
Yes. I wanted to know about the internal process of writing your first story, because you came here when you were 11, so was this something that was always brewing in you that had to come out to write this, or was it something that occurred like in a year, or how did it come that it came out on paper?
I wish it were a year, no. I think it was always kind of there, but it took a long time before it actually materialized. So I worked on some other things before, until I needed to be a little older to tackle this book, I think. And it took a good, I'm embarrassed to say, it took a good 7 years from start to publication. So it wasn't an easy process, but it was there all along. And you know, what's funny is that the books I initially tackled had to do with similar themes of political oppression and so on, but they were set in South America, or, you know. And finally I thought, well, why is this set in South America? Why? I have the material for Iran, you know, so it's, you know, it took time.
Yes, back there, yes, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment, because people were talking about some things that I'm terribly familiar with. I'm about to end a 43-year career teaching English to international students and immigrants, the largest portion of which have been students from Iran. I've known probably literally thousands of them, and this is before you were born, I think. I had students before the revolution, and I'm also a terminal doctoral candidate in intercultural education. And one thing I want to say about this discussion about my ethnic group assimilated more than your ethnic group did, and we Americanized better faster than you people did, and therefore we're better Americans. Or this is a bunch of nonsense, because there's a lot of myth in American immigrant history. It's all in the math. There are people who say that Hispanics don't want to learn English. Nonsense. The children of all immigrants born in this country that go to school are Americans, who are native speakers of English or co-native speakers with their first language. The problem is that more people who speak Spanish keep arriving, and they come in larger numbers than the school is producing students, so you think nobody's learning English. That's kind of what happens. And the idea that what does Americanized mean? If a 50-year-old person comes to this country to live and lives in a community where there are other peers who do not, who also speak their language and are deeply entrenched in their original culture, they're going to form communities. That's the beauty of this country, because they leave little vestiges that we enjoy, like the restaurants and all these other things. But the children of all immigrants who come to this country are Americans, often hyphenated with a lot of knowledge of previous culture, which I think is of tremendous value to our society. So the idea that that Cubans don't want to be Americans, Cubans were very much like Iranians. They came here thinking they were going back. But the children of all Cubans who are born in this country learn English, and so on, they are Americans. And the same thing for Iranian Americans. So I really would want to say that don't think that because a culture has communities that appear to be insular, which usually involve the older members of the community, that does not mean that people are not having families that are assimilating into American society. That's all I want to say. Thank you so much for your book, because you're talking about things that I've heard about from my students for years and years and years.
Thank you, Rana.
I have two questions. One is, why do you think that it's important for new generations to speak the language? And the second one is, how do you do that? Because nowadays, moms are going to schools, becoming educated, and it's all in English, and the kids are, it's not, they don't have an Iranian private school to go to, and they're going to either public schools or Jewish schools where they learn Hebrew and English. So it's very difficult to keep assimilating with English and keeping Jewish traditions and the language, and on top of that, to teach them Farsi. So what, I mean, how do
you... I think you're absolutely right. And that's why I was saying, each person really needs to examine and ask him or herself, what does this mean to me? And maybe the answer is, it doesn't mean enough, and I'm willing to let it go. But it has to be a kind of choice to really say, I'm going to let it go. Because I think it's being let go by default. So all I'm saying is maybe if enough people think that it's important, maybe some ways, I'm not in public education, but maybe enough situation could be created to make it important. But maybe people will decide that it's not important to them, and that's, but then that does lead to the vanishing of that culture, because, already the American kids of Iranians hardly speak English. I went to a Nowruz celebration at Asia Society, which is a museum in New York, and there were a lot of kids there, sort of kid-oriented. Most of them had never, Nowruz is a Persian New Year, sorry, and most of them had never really seen one. It was sort of this strange, and it was odd that it was in a museum, because it sort of, to me, it was sort of sad. I mean, it was lovely, it was joyous, it was well done, but it was sort of, it had already been relegated to history in some way. And it was sort of this cultural thing to partake in, in a museum. And so if that's what we're willing to do, then that's fine. That's a decision.
Mary.
Thank you for such a rich discussion and a wonderful topic that really touches all Jews, because all Jews have been in exile. We are all in a diaspora multiple times, and everybody has a view on it, but we're all traditional. intentionally looking to return for the return. So just having been away and coming back, it's so interesting. And I've had many conversations with people on campus about the criminal reactions of the Persians who seem to hold it so dear, going back to their most recent exile. And Russians, for one, say, you know, we don't feel that attachment to Russia. But then I'm thinking of the Sephardim, who also have such a strong attachment to Spain. And for 500 years, they were able to keep their language alive, maybe because the host country, as someone here suggested, was more accepting of having that. And maybe because they came from, maybe it's the Arabic, even where they came from originally, was more accepting of having a dual identity. I don't know what you think about that, but the Spanish kids were living under Arab rule, and the Persians, not Arab, but Arabic speaking, and maybe an Eastern culture as opposed to the Christian Europe. I don't know if that's the question.
So what is the question then?
Do you think that some of the difference of holding on to this, of feeling this comfort with a dual identity, has to do with either the country that you came from or the country that you're going to, whether they accept that dual identity? Somebody's here saying that America is not so accepting of dual identities, wants people to be American, where some other countries may have been. Persians didn't seem to have a problem with being Jewish and Persian.
I mean, again, I'm not an expert, I'm not a sociologist, so I hesitate to make grand comments about host countries and so on, but I don't know. In my experience, America is quite accepting of dual identities.
Well, I think for Persians under the Pahlavi regime, it was easy to be both Persian and Jewish. I think that changed when the Islamic Revolution came about, and under Khomeini, it was okay to be Jewish, but you couldn't be a Zionist, and so they made that differentiation between being a Jew, but you can't support the state of Israel. And what you find, and you see this a lot, is that the Persians in Iran really go out of their way to show support for a Palestinian cause or for the Islamic Revolution or Khomeini or Khomeini now, because they know that at any point someone could come in from the Revolutionary Guard, grab them, imprison them, and there is no one who will defend them or protect them. And so, but I do think that for a very long time, Iranian Jews were able to live under Zoroastrian rule. It changed under Shia rule in the 16th century up until 1925. And then when Reza Pahlavi came, and then Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, things really changed. And that's why you get this very different narrative. If you're reading historical books and they talk about the Pahlavis, they don't talk about them in a great way because there was a lot of corruption, and you know, you have the secret police, the Savak, etc. But in my interviews with Iranian Jews, you know, the Pahlavis were, you know, almost like a messianic figure because they liberated the Jews, they allowed them to become a part of the Nouveau Riche and work their way up in society, and you know, they almost saw them as a lineage of coming from King Cyrus, who was the only non-Jew in the Hebrew Scriptures described as a messianic figure because he liberated the Jews and allowed them to go back to Jerusalem. It was the same thing with the Pahlavis in a sense. So there's a very different narrative for Iranian Jews. They really love the Pahlavi regime because they were, some of them, not a lot of them. It depends on who you speak to, but for the most part, they let them come out of the Jewish ghettos and they let them be a part of society. And they weren't no longer tainted with being Najas, which meant impure.
You think that's what the attachment is about?
No, I think the attachment is being in a country for 2,700 years.
Yeah, I think it kind of goes beyond maybe questions of the Pahlavi regime itself. I mean, you're right. I mean, there are always this kind of royalists among
The romanticization. When people talk about Iran, it was as if it was the most important, the most amazing place in the world. And I think a lot of immigrants do that with memories.
Right, but I think that those people tend to be the sort of people who show up at Persian parades with the Cyrus costumes and so on.
Right.
And it's, I don't know if that's true attachment or, as you say, it's kind of this idealized version of a country, but I'm talking about a kind of true, how do you define that? A true love, you know, for a place, or a place that's beyond a ruler or a regime and so on. Yeah.
Okay, well, we will end now because it's getting a little late. But thank you, Dahlia, so much. We are so excited for your new book. And hopefully you'll come back.